He and Jenny Boone were paired immediately behind the agent. Jenny offered her hand, and Harley was grateful for it. They began to move again, with all the people watching as if waiting to pounce. Harley did not glance at his mother, and neither did he search the crowd for his father, who was surely there. He didn't know where he and the other kids were going, or how long it would take to get there, and he didn't know what waited for them at the end of the journey. But it didn't matter, because there was nothing for them in Iron Furnace anymore. Chapter 28. Like mannequins invoked to life and summoned here from retail tableaus to herald the abolition of humanity, these flesh-and-blood drones still posed a threat, as far as Jane was concerned. Nanotech brain implants were the work of science, though for all intents and purposes, these individuals were bespelled. The oldest stories that people told one another before there were books had been stories of spells cast, and spells broken. As she led the kids through the throng to the open front gate and off the property, she glanced back repeatedly and saw Luther at all times scanning the crowd. Vehicles were parked haphazardly along the shoulders of the two-lane blacktop. No headlights approached, suggesting that not all 600 of Iron Furnace's citizens were thought necessary to answer the alarm that had been sent through the whispering room. Her Ford and Luther's rented Chevy were parked 100 yards west of the estate. They loaded 4 kids into each vehicle, and then the two of them conferenced at the back of Luther's rental.
"That was hairy," she said.
"Still is.
We have to get them across the state line, just in case some legitimate Kentucky authority gets involved."
"Agreed. Quickest is down to Tennessee. Then where?"
"Texas, if you're game for that." As they talked, they watched the exit from the estate, wondering if there might be a limit to how long these programmed people would remain open to being commanded after they had responded to the access line, "Play Manchurian with me."
"What's in Texas for them?"
Luther asked. "A place I know about. I'll tell you later."
"I've got to call Rebecca."
"You do, for sure. And you and I have to talk about that. But let's close this out and get across the state line first." She'd taken a disposable cell phone from the console box in the Ford. Now she used it to call Seth Donner's smartphone, though she was half convinced that the big man would no longer be sitting patiently in the armchair in his room.
"Hello," he said.
"It's me. Do you remember?"
"Yeah. You said you'd call."
"There are 3 things you have to do."
"All right."
"As soon as I hang up, go to the whispering room. Send a message to everyone in Iron Furnace. Can you do that?"
"Yeah. What message?"
"You will say, 'Play Manchurian with me.'"
"All right."
"And they will all respond as you just did. After they respond, you'll tell them to forget the alarm that George sent out. Tell them to forget they were ever called to the school. Tell them to forget everything and everyone they saw at the school. Do you understand, Seth?"
"Yeah."
He repeated what she had told him. "Good. Very good." Remembering the pages of Cora Gunderson's repetitious writing that Luther had shown her, Jane said, "There's a phrase in German that puts an end to each Manchurian game. You know it, don't you?"
"Yes."
"You'll repeat it in the whispering room after you've told them to forget."
"I will."
"Next, is there a security video recorder at the school, a place where video from all the cameras is stored?"
"Yeah. It's in the pantry. There's a disk."
"Yes. It will be stored on a disk and probably a backup disk. Take the disks out of the machine, Seth, and put them in a bucket with a few ounces of gasoline, and take them out to the patio and set them on fire. Do you understand?"
"I understand."
"When the fire burns out, throw whatever remains of the disks in the lake. Will you do that?"
"I will." You said I should.
Yes, I did. One more thing. After you've thrown the remains of the disc in the lake, go back to your room and lie down.
All right.
Lie down and go to sleep and forget everything that's happened tonight. Sleep and forget me and the guy who was with me. While you sleep, forget what happened to the children. And while you sleep, forget everything I've just told you to do. He was silent. Seth?
Yeah?
Can you do all of that?
Sure, he said.
Better get started now, Seth.
I will.
Auf Wiedersehen. She terminated the call and switched off the disposable cell, which she could not risk using again. She would toss it out of the car on the way to Tennessee. Before she and Luther had set out from the garage with the children, she'd given him a 1-minute condensation regarding what she had learned about the Whispering Room. Although he'd heard only her side of this call to Seth Donner, he knew enough to understand the general shape of what she had just done. For a moment, he regarded her sternly, as if perhaps she might be the criminal mastermind that the media claimed.
When the hell did you figure that out and put together what to do?
On the fly.
I guess it had to be.
We can swing through Morning Dove and get your luggage at the motel and still be in Tennessee in 90 minutes, maybe 75, depending.
Don't drive so fast you lose me.
I thought you Hicks sheriffs knew how to run a tail.
Damn it,
Luther said.
I'm scared shitless about what we're up against. Don't you go making me laugh.
Chapter 29. At a truck stop in Tennessee, they fueled the cars and bought sodas for everyone, but they delayed a bathroom break until they got to a roadside rest stop at 10:40 p.m., where there wasn't an audience to see and wonder about the children in their stocking feet. To discourage thieves and worse from preying on motorists who used these facilities, the comfort station and its wooded grounds were so brightly lit that the scene was as unreal as a highly stylized stage setting. The black shadows and white light, geometric forms in stark conflict, seemed to symbolize something profound, as if an avant-garde play of singular tedium was about to be performed. The cameras didn't worry Luther. In such installations, the video equipment was out of service half the time. The lenses were rarely cleaned. Some cameras would be unfunctioning shells, a cheap way to dissuade predators and provide false comfort to the prey. At a distance from the restrooms stood two concrete picnic tables with benches under the limbs of basswoods that were neither winter stark nor in fullest leaf. Luther sat on a bench to use his disposable cell to call the like phone he had left with Rebecca. She answered at once, and he said,
"You know, I love you more than life itself."
"You're scaring me," she said.
"I don't want to, but I will.
Something bigger than I ever imagined is going on."
After a silence, she said, "That's all you're gonna tell me?"
"It's all I have time for. It's big, and I don't know what it's going to do to us, the family, our future. Until we know how things are shaping up, we've got to plan for the worst."
He told her what she needed to do. It was a testament to Rebecca's trust in him, her quickness of mind, and her well-honed survival instinct that she didn't balk and didn't ask why, because she intuited why in every instance. When he terminated the call, he sat for a moment in the night shade of the basswoods, in the fragrance of honeysuckle, listening to tree frogs and crickets calling to their kind, and the made world had never seemed more precious to him. As he gazed out from nature's comfort at the blacktop parking lot, so barren in the cold fall of hard light, he asked for courage and for mercy,
and if that should be too much to ask, then for courage alone.
Part 5. Finding Jane.
Chapter 1.
Harley Higgins murmured, deep in dreams, slumped in the safety harness of the front passenger seat. Sally and Nora slept in the back seat, while Jenny Boone nestled among the suitcases in the luggage area forward of the tailgate. Out of Nashville to Memphis, to Little Rock, and into western Arkansas, under a sky from which clouds withered and into which grew a moon and stars, Jane was the only one awake in the Ford Escape, owl-eyed on caffeine tablets and energy drinks, her heart given wings by the successful extraction of the 8 children from that village of the damned. For grueling weeks, her days had been shaped more by iron determination than by hope, because hope too ardently embraced could lead to disappointment, and disappointment to a sense of failure. But based on this triumph, small as it might be in the scheme of things, a large dose of hope healed the most recent wounds to her spirit. Luther knew the route they were taking, and their destination. They had nonetheless arranged a few rendezvous points along the way at which they could reconnect if they became separated. They both had burner phones to stay in touch as required. They needed to get him and the kids out of the rental car to which his name was tied, and replace it with wheels that didn't come with a GPS. She was loath to drive all the way across northern Texas to Nogales, Arizona, to visit Enrique DeSoto, from whom she had purchased her Ford. A possible alternative existed here in Arkansas, though she was taking a risk by arriving unannounced. Besides, it wasn't a property on which children were certain to be safe. Although the number of places in this world where children were inarguably safe diminished day by day. Chapter 2. In the first light of that cold Wednesday morning, Deputy Rob Stassen pulled the 61 Buick station wagon out of the barn that served as a garage for his and Melanie's vehicles. He had a Ford crew cab pickup he loved, not as much as he loved his wife, but more than he loved their cat, and Melanie had a Honda. And the Buick was used by both of them, though not often. Rob had long meant to bring the Buick up to showroom condition, but he'd attended only to its mechanicals. The car ran smooth, but some of the sleek, contoured body needed work, dings to repair, small areas of rust to cut out, and instead of a cool paint job, it sported gray primer. He was embarrassed to get out of it and hand the keys to Rebecca Tillman.
"It's not exactly elegant transportation," he said.
Wearing a leather coat with a plush rabbit fur collar, petite and yet somehow seeming taller than Robbie, the sheriff's wife said, "She sounds like she's tip-top."
"She'll get you to Wisconsin and back, easy." "So, you and Jolie are helping your mom's sister move in with her?"
"Neither of them should be living alone. Mom refuses to come live with us, says Minnesota is one step removed from the far side of the moon. Of course, they would decide they just have to do it now, with Luther driven off for the week in Iowa."
"Visiting his old college buddies, huh?"
"They hang out every other year, doing guy stuff. Guys gone wild in sleepy Des Moines can't get into any really big trouble."
"Roger and Palmer," Rob said. "He's talked about them, but it's usually a summer thing."
"Palmer's health isn't so good. Better not wait till August."
"Sorry to hear that."
"Robbie, you're a peach. Thank you so much for lending me the station wagon. My Toyota would be no good to move Aunt Tandy." He patted the flank of the Buick.
"This is a big girl. She'll get the job done. The radio works, but there's no GPS.
I don't like that robot girl's voice anyway. Sounds a little snotty." She kissed him on the cheek and got behind the wheel, and he closed the door for her. He watched her drive away, clouds of vapor billowing from the tailpipe in the crisp morning air. He liked the sheriff's wife and knew she was a good woman, not just good for Luther, but good to the bone. Nevertheless, he wondered about the true reason she wanted to borrow the 61 Buick, and where she and her daughter Jolie were really going with it. Chapter 3. The Ouachita Mountains of Arkansas were worn low by millennia of weather. In the cool morning, the undulant road provided vistas of diminished mountains and deep hollows where mist pooled close to the ground and drifted like a memory of snow against slopes of pines and hardwoods, miles and miles of nearly uninhabited land. Jane had been here once before. The single-lane, oiled dirt entry lay directly across the state route from a steep wall of dark rock veined with quartz that pulsed with early sun. She turned onto that narrow track, surrounded by such a tight arc of forest that she was essentially driving through a tunnel. The kids had awakened. They sat, yawning and blinking at the wilderness, where light penetrated the canopy in shafts of pinched diameter, as if the sun were stilting across the woods on countless poles. Luther followed her in the rental car. 50 yards from the paved road, the lane turned sharply right, bringing her to a gate made from 3-inch diameter pipe and fitted between steel posts set in concrete footings. The gate was even stronger than it looked, especially because the short approach prevented any vehicle from achieving enough speed to ram it. No call box was provided for a visitor. The entrance to Otis Faucheur's domain was always guarded, if not in an obvious fashion. They waited at the gate for 3 minutes before their patience convinced the sentry that they understood the protocols and must have been here previously. Bushy-haired and bearded, he materialized out of shadows and in a phosphorescent mist, like some satyr who lived within a tree's heart but could manifest in the flesh at will. He carried an automatic shotgun with an extended magazine. Under a roomy, untucked shirt, he would have access to at least a pistol and spare ammo for both weapons. In addition to this man, there would be 2 others more heavily armed at other points in the nearby woods. After openly studying both vehicles for a minute or more, the guard came around the front of the Ford to the driver's door as Jane put down the window. Surrounded by the dark mass of hair and beard, his face was sun-browned, his eyes as black and pitiless as those of a falcon.
"You ain't ought to be here, ma'am."
His gaze slid to the girls in the back seat, to Harley, and again to Jane.
"Nothing here for young'uns like them."
"I need to see Otis Faucheur."
"Ain't never heard of him."
"If not for me, his son Dozier would be on death row."
"Never heard of no Dozier, neither."
"Call your boss. Tell him the girl with rattlesnake piss in her veins needs to see him. And don't tell me he's not up so early. He's an insomniac, hasn't slept more than 3 hours a night in years." Bent to the window, the sentry remained eye to eye with her for a long moment, then said,
"Ain't only me round about."
"I figure I'm under at least 2 guns, not counting yours," she said. "I'm not enough of a damn fool to try anything, even if that's what I was here for, which it isn't." He stepped off the road and out of the lines of fire the other guards maintained. He brought a talkabout from under his shirt and conversed with someone in a voice too soft for her to hear.
"I think I want to be FBI,
Harley Higgins said. "I don't recommend it."
"Well, I mean, I want to be like you."
"Sweetie, you already are like me. We're both on the run." The guard opened the gate with a remote and waved them through.
The forest continued lower through the hollow until trees gave way to meadow. Otis Faucheur's house stood foremost on the cleared land, a family-crafted two-story cedar residence, long weathered to a gray that matched the fur of the English shorthair cats Otis had kept until his third wife proved allergic to them. After telling the kids to stay in the car, she got out and closed the door and stood listening to a silence rare in the modern world. Morning birds remarked on the day to one another, but their voices only emphasized the depth of the hush that otherwise lay on the land. Other cedar houses stood farther back in the meadow, connected by the loop of oiled lane. The family business buildings were hidden from aerial view, snugged in the woods. This must be the most stable criminal enterprise in the South, if not in the entire country. The location seemed remote, beyond most conveniences. There was electric power. However, because generations of friendly relations with the county's political structure and key figures at the state level ensured not only that the Faucheurs wouldn't be molested as they went about earning a living, but also that they would receive no less access to essential utilities than other taxpayers, though they never paid taxes. On the roof were three satellite dishes. Otis awaited her in a rocking chair on the front porch. 65 with a merry face, he must have paid graft to time as well, because the few soft folds in his countenance made it more pleasant than it otherwise might have been, and there was nothing in it to suggest he'd ever known a worry. He wore hush puppies, khakis, a white shirt buttoned to the throat, a black string tie, and a straw hat set square on his head. He rose partway from his chair and half bowed as she came up the porch steps. There were only two chairs, a table between them, a glider at the farther end of the porch, and a couple pots of ivy hanging on chains from the ceiling. Otis sat again when she settled in the chair beside his.
"Girl, you sure done thrown yourself down a long stair of trouble."
"I didn't know you kept up with current events."
"Keeping up with your events is like to wear a man my age down to a nub. I just dip in and out from your ongoing story."
"Nothing's what they say it is," she assured him.
"Nothing never is. I'm wondering, why here? Why me? Why now?"
"I saved your son from life in prison, the death penalty."
"Dozier never was no serial killer. They wronged him. You righted him by indirection. You never done it out of Christian love for Dozier. You was just doing what you do.
When he brought me here that time to meet you, he asked you to help me, like I was kin, if ever the time came.
I got myself 11 sons and 7 daughters. You go around saving them all. I can't be spending my life doing payback favors."
"I'll spare you that burden if we can do business just once." He picked up a tin of snuff from the little table between the chairs.
"Take a peck."
When she declined, he tucked a pinch in one cheek.
"You was here that time. I seen how you are. Remember how I says to you, whatever you done for Dozier, you'd like nothing more than squashing our pitiful little business."
"Do you remember what I said to that?" she asked.
"Maybe, if I think some on it."
"I said you're right. You make whatever drugs the market wants. You deal in bulk across the South. You ruin lives. You should be taken down hard. But I'm not a quarterback for lost causes. Say I referred you to the Drug Enforcement Agency, which I never did. But if I had, they would have come up against politicians who'd whack-a-mole for you until everyone gave up, and I'd be tagged as a crusader with no judgment about what can and can't get done. That's when you said I had rattlesnake piss for blood. I think it was a compliment." He had not been rocking in the rocking chair. Now he started. He stared out at the cars, where the faces of children pressed to the windows to get a look at him. In time, he said,
"Who might be the big feller in the coupe?"
"He's a sheriff up in Minnesota."
"Sheriff, is he? The Bible kind?"
"You opening a northern branch?"
"Just wondering how he is."
"I don't think there's any price you could pay that he'd stoop low to pick up."
"Yet here he be, off the rails with you."
"Some of his friends and neighbors were killed in this event up there. He took it very hard. Even a lot harder than he realizes." Otis continued rocking. The gathered pools of mist reached for the ascending sun with vaporous hands that withered away in the reaching.
"You mean the crazy woman done blowed up the governor?"
"She wasn't crazy the way you think."
"I don't think one way or t'other. It's just what the news called her. They flang words around till nothing means anything."
A small, busy beetle scurried across the porch planks on some mission in its micro-world.
"Fools what chop off heads, shoot up crowds in nightclubs. You ever think how maybe some in the government don't mind a bit?"
"Why wouldn't they?"
"Keeps us little people distracted."
Otis didn't seem to be looking at the floor, but he abruptly brought the chair to a halt until the tiny beetle passed safely under the curved rocker rail, and then he began to move again. "Distracted from what?" Jane asked. He had not been looking at her since she'd sat down. Now he favored her with a twinkling glance and a half-smile.
"Like you don't know from what. From these schemes and depravities."
Otis turned his attention to the cars once more, and after a silence, Jane said, "What I need is some vehicle, old and beat up and pokey-looking, but white lightning fast and reliable. No GPS."
"You got to have yourself an outrunner. But they's no car peddler in these parts."
"Like you don't have a fleet of them tarped among the trees." He shook his head, and a green-winged fly flew from the brim of his straw hat.
"Girl, you tickle me."
"I also need one of your people to drive that rental car back to the Louisville airport and drop it off."
"That be where the sheriff rented it?"
"Yes."
"Long way to Louisville."
"It does me no good if the car disappears. And I need you to turn back the odometer so it looks as if he only drove it in and around Louisville."
"You reckon I should fit her some new tires, change her oil, give her a washing, slap on an I Love Jesus bumper sticker?"
"Getting it back to Louisville is good enough. And there's one more thing."
"Just the one more, is it?"
"When your various children come of age, are you still sending them off to college?"
"Them that wants it. They's a few don't, no matter how hard you push them towards it."
"Dozier writes software. He mentioned an older sister who's a cardiologist, a brother who's a clinical psychologist."
"Don't have no problem what a child wants to be. Except they got to swear a lord's oath never to go in politics. I don't raise them up to get soiled with that."
"Might one of your children be an architect?"
"That there'd be something, wouldn't it? A faux-sure spinning places out his mind, then made real. Closest we come is a builder."
"What kind of builder?"
"The kind what builds things."
"By any chance, is he in San Francisco?"
"By no chance. He's down to San Diego, got a city by the tail there. Though he'd done work other places, including Frisco."
"I'd like an address for him. A number." His blue-gray eyes seemed to have gone more gray than blue when he turned his head to study her.
"So then you can pull him into your trouble with you?"
"You know I never would."
"How come would I know that?"
"I could have gone to Dozier and asked about an architect. That way I'd have found out about your builder, but that might have put two of them at risk. He made her meet his eyes for a long spell, and then he returned his attention to the cars.
Smart, the way you come with them children in tow.
I didn't have any choice.
What's they's story?
They're orphans.
You make them that way?
No. I'm trying to get them to a place where they'll be safe. He regarded her again, his stare like a flensing knife.
They wasn't here. You'd be cold in the woods, a bullet in your pretty head, waiting for a grave to be dug. They's a dead shot rifleman got you in his sights since you come out the car.
That's not who you are.
So now you know me better than I know myself.
Not better. Just well enough. You'll do this for me, but you want to scare me off ever coming back.
You need to think that way, you will. But it don't say much for your common sense.
In payment for the Outrunner and for taking the rental to Louisville, I can pay you $12,000. Earlier, she had taken $20,000 from the tote bag in the car and separated it into five packets.
$12,000,
he laughed and shook his head.
I don't spit for $12,000.
I'm not asking you to spit. $14,000 is my limit.
$20,000.
I have 8 kids to take care of. It's not all about you, Mr. Faucheur. He rolled his eyes and looked at the porch ceiling.
All sudden now, it's Mr. Faucheur. If I told them how you are, there's a world of people won't believe a word. $18,000.
$15,500. That's it. No more.
For the Outrunner and taking the rental to Louisville? So how much do you have for my builder boy's number?
You'll need to throw that in as a courtesy.
A courtesy?
Yes. He took off his straw hat and smoothed his white hair and put the hat on again, which proved to be a prearranged signal. A rifle shot cracked, and the nearer hanging pot shattered. Shards of terracotta and potting soil and tangles of ivy spilled onto the porch floor. Jane sat, staring at the mess, listening to echoes of the shot wash back and forth in the hollow and reverberate in the surrounding forest. When silence returned, she said, "You'll still have to throw it in as a courtesy."
That there wasn't part of negotiations. Just making a point.
She said, "All right, then." She took 4 packets of $100 bills from the 5 that she'd stashed in her sport coat pockets. She peeled 500 off one packet and kept that and put the rest on the table between them. He got up from his chair and looked down at her.
Dozier never should have brung you here that time. He knowed better, but he's just that way.
He was grateful, that's all. I'm proud of you.
You be quiet now. Let me say my piece. There's 2 reasons a blessed pretty girl's not waiting graveside in the woods. First, them children. But you come here again, children won't count for nothing. You'll get put down for a long sleep with worms.
He paused, and she said nothing, and her silence seemed to please him.
There's the other reason.
You do so tickle me, I admit.
Never knowed a one like you. But next time, being who you are won't buy you 2 minutes. Now you go wait out the rental car. About 30 minutes, a young man gonna bring round your Outrunner with paperwork says it's yours. What name you want on that?
I'm not reaching for anything but a driver's license with the information.
Go ahead, then.
She took 6 driver's licenses from an inner jacket pocket and stripped the rubber band off them and sorted through them, and gave him one in the name of Melinda June Garlock of Riverside, California. Leaving the money on the table, he went into the house. As Jane got up from her rocking chair, a pretty woman of about 40 came out of the front door. Jane had met her a few years earlier when Dozier had brought her to visit. Margot Faucher, third wife and mother of the youngest generation that had not yet gone away to college.
"You all right, dear?" Margot asked.
"I've been better." Picking up the cash from the table, Margot said,
"Oh, don't go letting that old bear scrape your nerves. He grumps, but don't bite."
"He's got some bite in him," Jane disagreed. "But it's not him. It's the world out there."
"I heard some about you and the world. None true, I'm sure."
She smiled and looked out at the cars and said,
"I would have brung along tea and coffee and cookies for the children, but seems it's not that kind of moment."
"We're fine," Jane said. "I'll just wait out at the car."
"You take care of yourself," Margot said.
"You too. Nice to see you again."
"It was. It truly was."
The lakes of mist that pooled here and there across the long hollow were surrendering their substance to the day, greater swaths of green meadow appearing by the minute. The family built cedar houses more silver than gray in the brighter sun. Widely separated tulip trees reigned over the open ground, the many species of the forest trees like ramparts all around. It resembled some Amish farm cooperative. No farming was done here, however, not even of cannabis. Bulk chemicals came in, were combined, were refined into an illegal drugs smorgasbord. From here, the merchandise went out into a world gone awry, to deeply troubled people who bought what they needed to get through the night, face the day, and escape them both. Luther had gotten out of his car when he'd heard the rifle shot, and he'd been standing by the open door ever since. When Jane joined him, he said,
"Are you all right?"
"Why is everybody asking me that? We'll have the vehicle we need in half an hour." Surveying the hollow, he said,
"Glad to hear it. This is a bad place."
"Yeah," she said. "But the funny thing is, I feel safer here than anywhere since Nick died." Chapter 4. Otis Faucher supplied a cranberry red 1988 Chrysler Voyager, a minivan, with weather-eaten paint, rust-streaked rocker panels, one of six grill segments broken out, and a general air of senescence. But jammed in the resized engine compartment was a GM Performance Parts 383 CI stoked small block V8 with a steel crank, hydraulic roller cam, 9.7-to-1 slugs, and a set of fast-burn aluminum heads. In fact, the entire chassis was new. Only the body survived from 88. The sole giveaway to the casual observer might have been the tires, which could take whatever punishment the outrunner demanded of them. Luther had no difficulty keeping pace with Jane's Mexico-souped Ford Escape. In a shopping center parking lot in Fort Smith, Arkansas, she measured the children's feet and did some estimating. Luther took her notes into a store and purchased 12 pairs of sneakers. From that assortment, they shooed the 8 properly without drawing undue attention. He also bought underwear and socks in various sizes. Famished, they ate a late breakfast in a restaurant where the food was delicious and the portions generous, and where Jane felt safe from recognition. No one was searching for Luther Tillman, and no authorities were looking for the kids, not officially, not so that their precious faces would be on TV. Jane had her long auburn hair and green eyes and unnecessary glasses, but the best disguise was her black companion and the covey of rumpled but content young ones. Few would imagine America's most wanted fugitive might travel with so many children. Adopted, they told the waitress. Or that a woman known to be a traitor and murderer and thief would be this same loving mother, or that such well-behaved boys and girls would regard the monstrous Jane Hawk with such trust and quiet affection. From Fort Smith, they crossed into Oklahoma. The heavens were china blue, with a few long stratus cloud formations like series of low, snow-covered hills risen from the earth and gliding eastward. At 2:40 p.m., Wednesday, in Oklahoma City, they transitioned to I-35 South. They intended to be in Ardmore by 5 o'clock and stay the night. Most of the way, one or another of Jane's namesake birds was making lazy circles in the sky, either to the east or west of the highway. Chapter 5. Huey Darnell, thrice divorced by Harridans and now betrayed by his fourth wife, Bourbon Whiskey, sits alone and dismayingly sober in the back of a paneled van, just behind the front seats, watching the Tillman residence through a pair of binoculars. Hassan Zaghari had been on duty this morning when the daughter, Jolie, drove her mother to the home of a deputy, Rob Stassen, to borrow an ancient Buick station wagon. Having followed them to and from the deputy's place, when at home once more they began to load suitcases in the Buick, Zaghari had called Huey for instructions. Fortunately, the women delayed until the bank opened and went in there together, which gave Huey time and an opportunity to fix a transponder to their borrowed vehicle. Now, Hassan Zaghari and Kernan Beadle, the only other agent on Huey's reduced team, are following Rebecca and Jolie Tillman to God knows where, and Huey is left alone to keep track of the sheriff, who is on vacation, and who surely must be, who damn well better be, in the house, lounging in pajamas or sweats, eating cheese doodles and drinking beer and watching sports. No one has glimpsed the sheriff since this surveillance began the previous day, Tuesday. Huey Darnell is long past due to report this situation to his boss, Booth Hendrickson. He is hoping that if he makes the sacrifice of remaining stone-cold sober long enough, the gods will reward him and all of this will turn out to be of no importance, so that he never needs to tell anyone that he is screwed up. He doesn't believe in gods, or God, or fate, or that the arc of history inevitably bends toward justice. However, maybe he is wrong about all those things. And if, for the moment, he is unable to believe in Bourbon, well, a man has to believe in something. Chapter 6. By Wednesday afternoon, the basic facts of the crisis are known, though the dimensions of the threat are not yet understood. Booth Hendrickson, of the Department of Justice and esteemed associate of David James Michael, airborne from D.C. to Louisville in a Bureau Gulfstream 5 jet, is then lifted from Louisville alone in an 8-seat executive helicopter. When the pilot settles the chopper in a meadow on the outskirts of Iron Furnace at 2:20 p.m. Wednesday, Hendrickson is met by one of the adjusted people of that town, Stacia Odell, the concierge at the Iron Furnace Lake Resort. Stacia serves as his chauffeur in a Mercedes S600 bearing the license plate IFLR1. Earlier, by telephone, Hendrickson accessed the woman's nanomachine implant by inviting her to play Manchurian with him. He programmed her to believe that his name is John Congreve, and that he's the CEO of Terra Firma Enterprises, which owns the resort. She is to escort him wherever he might wish to go, while having no curiosity as to his purpose, for this is said to be sensitive corporate business. The first place he wishes to go is to the private school for problem children. As they enter town on Lakeview Road, Stacia says, "It's a sad thing when little children are afflicted like that." "Yes," he agrees, "very sad." Curious as to what she might say, he asks, "What is their problem, as you understand it?"
"Personality disorders. There's more and more of that lately."
Absolutely. But I wonder why that is. Violent video games? Filth all over the internet? All the wrong lessons in the movies they're making these days? The schools failing them?
Oh, she says, maybe a little of it's about that, but mostly it's because there's not enough caring these days.
Caring?
For one another. Parents caring about their kids, neighbors caring about neighbors. All for one and one for all, you see?
I do see. Yes.
Everyone for himself is such a terrible dead end. I mean, when everything is me, 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 you're bound to have some children become confused, disordered. It's very sad.
Would you say that Iron Furnace is a caring town?
Her expression of concern melts into a smile. Oh, yes. We're a closely knit community. There's caring, unity, a sense of belonging. Just look around. You can see it, the way everything is. Yesterday, this event planner from Atlanta, Mr. Moses, the nicest black man, he said our little town is like a bejeweled Fabergé egg. She glances away from the road to gauge whether he's taken well what she has said, her apple-green eyes conveying earnestness that might move someone unaware that she is an adjusted person.
You really got that right, Ms. Odell. You surely do.
At the estate where the children are held, he asks her to remain in the car, under the portico roof. Of course, she will wait dutifully, patiently, perhaps even until she dies of thirst. A woman named Noreen Klostner answers the door, and Hendrickson asks her to play Manchurian with him, and then to use the whispering room to summon the other 7 staff members. When everyone is seated in the dining room, he accesses them and tries to ascertain how they could have been so delinquent as to allow the children to escape unnoticed. Yes, the locators in the shoes. But once the kids crept through the house in their stocking feet, where did they go? Nobody knows. Where are they now? Nobody knows. They can't be hiding anywhere in Iron Furnace because groups of citizens have searched everywhere for them. The oldest boy might have been able to drive, but no vehicle is missing from the garage. And what has happened to the security video? Nobody knows. Where are the discs that were removed from the recorder? Nobody knows. The 8 sit at the table, blank-faced. For an hour, Hendrickson pulls their strings, uses every tool provided by their control program to extract from their memory the events of the previous night, with no success. They share a period of amnesia beginning at dinner and continuing until they had gone to bed, as though something went wrong in their programs, all at the same time. Because these adjusted people are incapable of lying to him or of concealing vital information by any manner of deceit, the usual techniques of a tough interrogation are of no use to him. Yet, out of habit, he finds himself using intimidation and inducing fear, even brutally, repeatedly slapping 2 women until one is bleeding from the lips, the other from her nose. He is chagrined to have resorted to such primitive measures, not because they are so primitive, but because there is no chance they will work with creatures like these. Just as Hendrickson is about to terminate the session in disgust, a fearful man named George Woolsey, sitting at the head of the table, declares,
"I'm not here to hurt you. Do you believe me?"
Hendrickson goes to him, stares down at him.
"Hurt me? What the hell are you talking about? Of course you can't hurt me. You belong to me."
George Woolsey's face is sickly pale, and his eyes regard his interrogator much as the eyes of a helpless, tethered horse might track with terror the encroaching flames of a stable fire. He says,
"Don't be afraid, George. Not of me."
"You're George, you dumbass," Hendrickson says. "What's wrong with you?"
Woolsey's voice is thick with misery.
What's happened to me?
Before Hendrickson can respond, Woolsey says,
Don't you know, George?
And then,
Something's happened. What was, isn't.
And finally,
Come back into the dining room, George. Sit down with the others.
Hendrickson studies Woolsey. Something has just escaped the black hole that swallowed his memories of the previous evening. You're repeating a conversation, aren't you? From last night? Woolsey says nothing.
Answer me, George. Who told you they weren't here to hurt you?
Woolsey rolls his eyes, his breathing quick and shallow.
Dredge it up, damn you. Remember, last night, who said they weren't here to hurt you? She did.
Woolsey wasn't looking at anyone at the table.
She? Who was she? I don't know.
Tell me about her.
She was
what, George? Tell me.
She was kind to me.
What else?
Woolsey works his mouth as if seeking an answer, but he isn't able to find one.
Tell me something else about her, George. Something. Damn you.
Anything. I don't. I can't. I don't know.
Someone had been here the previous evening, and the children are now with her. Someone who knows how to access these people and control them, and make them forget. There are factions among the Arcadians, as there are factions in any organization, but Booth Hendrickson is stunned by the possibility that one of them might turn traitor on the others. He presses Woolsey for a few minutes, to no avail.
All of you, be calm. Go to your rooms. Wait till we come to deal with you.
Because he doesn't free them with the phrase Auf Wiedersehen, they rise from the chairs as if they are a convocation of the living dead, solemn and silent, their eyes forward but seeming to gaze inward toward some devastation. Two women drip blood from their battered faces, the red droplets shimmering on the carpet and on the limestone floor, as though having come unstrung from some bead roll and here portending Hendrickson's fate. He can't look up from those scattered scarlet beads as he makes a phone call to summon specialists from certain laboratories in Virginia. They will need to conduct forensic exams of the keepers of the children, as if those 8 adjusted people are hard drives that have crashed. When he returns to the car, Stacia O'Dell smiles and says, Everything hunky-dory? He doesn't reply, but sits thinking for a moment. Iron Furnace is a valuable asset to the cause, a place that allows them access to many influential people who can be programmed either to serve the shaping of the better world to come, or to commit suicide at some moment in the future that is specified by the computer model as an ideal expiration date. But the usefulness of the town is jeopardized by the 8 children on the loose. He senses that the answer to the mystery of their escape is within his reach, that he has overlooked something that still eludes him.
Let's go, Ms. O'Dell.
Where to? He hesitates, then says, Back into town. I'd like to have a look around. It's another 15 minutes before Stacia O'Dell once more mentions the black event planner from Atlanta, Martin Moses, who has compared Iron Furnace to a jewel-encrusted Fabergé egg. Chapter 7. Late afternoon, Ansel Hawk was in the stables, observing the vet conduct a follow-up exam with his favorite horse, Donner.
The stallion had come down with coffin joint synovitis. Fortunately, the inflammation had been treated before any degeneration in the foot. Ansel's iPhone rang. When he saw who was calling, he excused himself and took the call as he moved to the farther end of the stable.
Is this really Chase Longren, or is my phone funning me?
How are you, Mr. Hawk?
I've been better, been worse, and been here before. No complaints. Your own self?
I'm in the same corral you just described, sir. As long as the food's good and the bed's warm, I'd be a fool to repine.
Chase had been Nick's best friend in high school. In their senior year, they were both smitten with the same girl, Alexis Ames, and contested for her attention. When she fell in love with the other, Nick handled his disappointment with grace, remaining best friends with Chase and treating Alexis like a sister. It was as if Nick had always known Jane would be there for him in a few years.
What can I do for you, son?
Remember last year you hounded me for that Tennessee Walker?
The chestnut mare with the golden mane and tail? I regret if you felt hounded. I'm just a truly persistent horse trader.
Her name's Melosa. You still like to buy her for Mrs. Hawk?
If ever a horse and woman were born to further glorify each other, it's them.
After that kind of talk, you won't whittle my price down.
Well, Melosa is a year older, thanks to your intransigence.
You're amusing to dicker with, sir. Anytime you want to come see Melosa, make sure her teeth haven't fallen out. You're welcome.
Why not now?
I could live with now.
I'll set out shortly, Ansel said.
Leaving the vet to report on Donner's condition to Juan Saba, the ranch manager, Ansel went to his Ford 550 truck in front of the house and fired it up. His heart was lighter than it had been in a while, though not because of any Tennessee walking horse. There was a Melosa in Chase Longren's stables, and Ansel would not mind buying her for Claire, but the purpose of the call had not been to sell a horse. As had been arranged when Jane went off the grid 2.5 months earlier, such a call meant that she had contacted Chase and that he had a message to relay to her in-laws. This was the first time she had rung him up. The long private lane between the house and the county road was flanked by ranch fencing, overhung in places by ancient oak trees. In this season, the world beyond appeared to offer only rich green grasslands, sheep grazing to the left and cattle on the right. Tens of millions of years earlier, most of Texas had been covered by shallow seas. The skeletons and shells of tiny creatures abiding there formed the sediment that compacted into the deep limestone bedrock, supporting all of what accrued in this territory thereafter. The land was the foundation on which a man and woman could build a life with hard work and love, with faith that it meant something. As long as Ansel could remember, he loved the land, but also the vastness of the sky, which was bigger here than in most places, the horizon as far away as aboard a ship in mid-ocean. He felt anchored by the earth and buoyed by the majesty of the big sky, so that life had a sweet tension. With Nick's death, the land seemed to fracture under Ansel, its millions of years of stability called into question. Some days the sky paled, as if it might fade to a white arc too empty and terrible for the eye to tolerate. Far horizons that once inspired by their distance now suggested that there were no longer limits in the world, that some never-imagined threat would come from beyond the curve of the earth and fall on them as they lay defenseless. He spoke to Claire about his grief, but not about its depth or about his fear that it would never diminish. She was suffering too, and if they were emotionally at sea here, where no sea had been for millions of years, his role must be to remain stoic and serve as the vessel that carried her from this sad time to a happier shore. Ansel's best hope, and Claire's,
of arriving at a better place, was the family that his son left behind. The imperiled woman Nick had loved with such intensity, the grandchild whom Ansel and Claire hardly knew. If the hope of the next world was God, the hope of this one was